Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who've both had a hell of a day. Anyways, we are your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And we're joined by two other gals who have also had a hell of a day or slash month. But we're all happy to be here with you guys having part two of our review chit chat. If you'll remember last time Christy and Brenda joined us, they were able to share all about review, except we didn't really dive into how we actually perform the review. And we also saved a little bit of fun for the end of our episode where we're going to share some review horror stories. This is the party end of the mullet. The first episode was the business front. Before we get started, though, Angie, I feel like we need to reintroduce Christy and Brenda just for anybody who didn't join us in the first part.
I would love to reintroduce our guests. So with us today, we have Christy McGowan and Brenda Dodd. This is their second go around with us. So clearly we aren't that terrible since you guys agreed to come back. Christy is the director of legal operations at Extero, an e-discovery service provider. She's also been an adjunct professor at UC Irvine, a director of infrastructure at SIFT Discovery. She's also been the chair of the law practice management technology section at the California Lawyers Association. And as if all of that was not enough, she has also founded her own eDiscovery company, eDiscovery Litigation Specialists. Welcome, Christy. And we also have Brenda. So Brenda is the director of product management at Extero. She's an innovative certified eDiscovery specialist with over 30 years of experience in the industry. She's very passionate about creating solutions that address complex legal challenges and leverages her unique combination of legal and technical experience. By doing that, she has helped law firms, corporations, and government entities successfully implement technology for cost-effective and efficient management and review of ESI. Christy, Brenda, welcome back. We are thrilled to have you and excited to talk to you again.
We are happy to be back. Okay. I don't know if Brenda is, but I am.
I'm thrilled to be back.
Well, before we dive into all this review talk, we did want to ask you something that might be kind of scary to discuss. At the end of our episode today, we will be talking about horror stories, which made me think about things that I am really afraid of. Brenda and Christy, what would you say is your biggest fear?
Work-wise or just in general?
Just in general.
I would say drowning. I don't like being underwater. I won't go scuba diving, probably missing out on a lot, but I would say drowning.
I see that there's another billionaire who's planning to take a submersible to go see the Titanic wreckage. So I'm guessing we can count you out of that mission.
I will stay here.
It freaks me out to be that far underwater.
Oh, hard pass.
What about you, Brenda?
Well, my biggest fear is snakes. And I have a story. So I'm so terrified of snakes to the point where I can't even speak when I see one. So a few weeks back, I turned around and there was a snake by my pool. And I pointed and tried to say something, but all that came out was, my husband thought I was having a stroke. So terrified of snakes.
Oh my gosh. What about you, Angie?
Eye level spiders. Like spiders at eye level. Like, I don't know why they ever need to be that close to my face, but I feel like my stomach falls out of my butt every time I see a spider like at eye level.
It's just crawling towards you.
Ugh, shudder.
It's funny because my biggest fear is also spiders. And I have a friend who knows that I'm so terrified of spiders. And she called me one night and she was like, you will never believe what just happened to me. And I said, what? She said that there was a spider running across her wall and she was trying to kill it with hairspray.
No.
And so what she did is that she hit it with her shoe. And when she did, all these babies came out. And she then sprayed her hairspray on the babies. And she's like, now I have all these dead spiders all over my wall and I want to die. I want to move out. Can you help me? I'm like, no. You're going to have to burn your house down. That is terrible.
I want to throw up.
Yeah.
That is so horrible.
So I was afraid of spiders, but now I'm like super afraid of pregnant spiders with babies in them. So just to be specific.
Oh
my God.
No, thank you. No, thanks.
Oh, sorry. God, enough about okay. that.
So I'm going to transition us. This is not a smooth transition. This is a hard left from spiders. So we have talked about all the various forms of data and tools that we would use to process it and make it available for review by an individual or by a team. I want to break down some of these terms for our listeners. Brenda, do you think you could give us a little bit more information on what do we mean when we talk about fields, metadata, content, culling, sorting? What is the review team actually doing with respect to those things?
The review team may not ever really get a good understanding of processing, right? But the terms that are really important to the review team are fields, metadata, right? How to call document sorting. Those are methods, but let's talk about fields and metadata first. So fields and metadata, metadata is basically data about the data, right? It's the document properties. It's the information about the document itself. Fields also could be the same as metadata, but it could be additional information about the document that reviewers are adding. For example, a note field could be appended to a coding panel, which would allow reviewers to add additional information about the document that could also be while they're looking at the metadata, but it's completely different than the metadata. As I said, the metadata is really related to the information about the document itself, right?
Gotcha.
From the document properties.
Okay, so metadata is going to be something that just lives with the document, comes along with it, and then fields are what you're actually using during the review process.
Yes, I mean, reviewers are going to definitely use the metadata too, because you're going to be filtering on that or analyzing that, right? So think of the metadata, for example, author, like the author of a document. I want to sort and find all of Brenda Dodd's documents that she's written over the past year. That would be filtering on a metadata field.
Gotcha. And so how can reviewers use fields and metadata to review more efficiently? And specifically, like how might they use it to cull down their data?
Great point. So metadata is so valuable when it comes to culling information, right? So think of if you didn't have that information, take my example of the author field, it would be very, very difficult to find all of the documents that were authored by Brenda, right? So being able to use a review tool that you can not only visualize those fields of information, but be able to search and filter and quickly get to that source of information that you're looking for is just an invaluable tool for the reviewers.
How might you use this in practice, like especially when it comes to finding things that are privileged, for example?
From a privilege perspective, think of it as looking for specific information about whose content may be privileged. So looking for email sender, senders, recipients, the domains, the law firm domains, if you're doing a review of your, the law firms that are working on your corporate matters, things of that nature would be really ideal for analyzing and potentially evaluating documents or, organizing them in a way that they may be most likely to be privileged and your reviewers may want to focus on them. So metadata in that sense is a great way to kind of call that information down or get to it rather quickly. There's other methods too. So for example, I've used review tools where you can pre-classify data during the processing that will populate a field, right? It's not the metadata, but it's going to populate a field that could say this document's potentially privileged. And that's also an invaluable tool for the reviewer. You're really looking to get to the most relevant data quickly as possible without having the, Angie, you know this because you're often paying the bills of your reviewers, right? You don't want to have them waste time looking at documents that are just not relevant or responsive to the issue at hand. So having these tools and being able to filter on metadata or fields is extremely valuable to cut to the chase. Let's just get rid of the junk and focus on what that is.
You want to think of that metadata as information you're not generally going to see on the face of the document, right? Some of that information is just not generally available if you're looking at a Word document.
So what's an example of that?
Who is the author of that Word document? Is it Angie? Is it Bree? Is Angie a lawyer within the company? Okay, let's find documents where Angie is the author. Those are privileged. Those are work products. So just think of things like that as you're going through this process of what information can I not see on the face of the document? That's the metadata you want to focus on because you can see the to and the from. That's in the email or that's on the document. What can't you see? We had a case where the latitude and longitude of a photo was super critical. Where was this person standing? when they took this picture. That's not on the face of the document. That is on the metadata. So just think of things like that as you're doing your review of documents of what can't I see?
Yeah. And I think that's such a critical point. And sort of in that same vein, when people imagine doc review, what comes to mind is often actual Word documents or emails and things like that. But what other data sources might we review?
I mean, these days, that's a pretty wide open question, right? Because think of all the various data sources or the applications that we use in our everyday life to just conduct business, or social life, social media files. Those are becoming more and more popular for collections that ultimately need to be reviewed. Even organizations use what we, you know, social media sites to some regard, right? Christy and I, we chat with each other all day long through Google Chat. Those are different than an email, but they still need to be reviewed. What about audio and video files, which could be pretty complex when it comes to, you know, how are we going to review these? Is a tool available to actually see and hear it, but also extract that text so that you can then search and filter on it so that the reviewer can find it. Every day, I feel like a new data type gets introduced or asked of me, hey, Brenda, can we process or can we ingest this data type? It's just constantly changing.
What are some like fun new data types that you've seen come across your desk?
I've actually got one, but it's not fun and it's not new, but it's something that we quite, you know, haven't really figured out how to address them, which is structured data. And I kind of talked about that on the last call we had. How do you deal with these large volume of data that's coming out of systems? Because every corporation like yours, Angie, is dealing with data on spreadsheets, right? It's all coming out of a platform. It's all exported into Excel. That's all structured data. How do you handle it? How do you analyze it? How do you get to what you need? Those are too large to put into a platform that's going to allow you to see them. Sorry, drop them into Microsoft Access. How do I get what I need in this Excel without it crashing?
I think it's been fun too to see the developments that have been made for data sources that we were able to get before, but they didn't look so hot, like chats. Now they look so much better and they're more palatable for reviewers. I personally think that's fun, but of course I'm an e-discovery nerd, so.
I think that's super fun too.
Not only is it amazing, but it's essential for the reviewer, right? You're not getting the full context of what is actually being said or the meaning behind it, right? What if you just part of a conversation where I am saying something to, say, Bree that looks like it could be problematic because I said something nasty and gave her the thumbs down emoji when
Brenda,
actually we were talking about something completely different, but you didn't get the full text of the conversation.
Context is critical.
Isn't that what lawyers like? They're like, I only want the piece of this. I don't want the whole story.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, we want the clickbait.
Well, it depends on what side you're on.
That's not the whole story. I like what this says right here.
Yeah, but this doesn't that go against what you learn? One of the first things you learn, don't ever ask a question you don't know the answer to. Well, if you don't have the full context, you're not going to be able to know the answer to that question.
Absolutely. Well, and the federal rules of evidence will allow you to move to complete the picture, basically. If you introduce evidence that is kind of incomplete in a way, you can be like, hey, court, we gotta let in the full picture here.
The record of completeness.
Yeah. So that brings up a whole nother. So you said, you know, what are the new things that we're talking about? One of the things that's really hot in the industry is the concept of modern attachments or those links. Documents that, you know, you get a hyperlink to them in an email or a chat. How do you collect them? Are you collecting them? Should you be collecting them? If you're collecting them, what version should they be collected? My personal opinion, without those documents and seeing that relationship, you can't review in context. You don't know the whole story.
So before we kind of go on to the next topic, I thought it might be helpful to explain OCR at this point. When we're looking in a review and we're searching for documents, whether it's culling down with the metadata fields or we're running search terms through the documents or data itself, a lot of what we're pulling back are hits for what's in the content of the document. And we can only pull that back if it's searchable. Brenda and Christy, for that matter, can you guys explain what OCR is and when it comes into play and maybe give us some tips of how you've seen it work best?
Definitely today, we're dealing with a lot of native documents. Unlike, you know, when I started out 30 some years ago, well, we didn't even have computers to actually review documents. I'm just kidding. We were close to that though, but making sure that documents were OCR'd was really imperative back then because we were scanning paper, right? Paper didn't automatically have the text. You'd have to scan it to get to extract all of that text to be able to search it. Fortunately, today, where I was going with this is a lot of our documents are coming natively, meaning it's the actual document. It comes with the text inherent with it. That's not to say that there's not documents today that are not searchable, right? So think of a PDF, a pure image PDF that you can't, extract, you can't hover over it, you can't search it, you can't do anything. Documents like that would need to be OCR'd because if you don't have OCR, if you don't have the text freeze, you hit the nail on the head, you can't search it. I'm going to also go back to, it takes a little bit further than OCR too. So OCRing means we're going to extract the text that's not already available and make it available so that your reviewers can search on it. But there's also I'm going to go back to my audio video, you're not extracting that or transcribing that. That also can't be searchable. OCRing and transcribing information is very important from a reviewer's perspective. When you're producing documents, and Christy, I was thinking maybe you'd want to take on this, after the review and you're producing documents, you always have to give the other side of the text. And without the text, that's really useless.
Yeah, I'm going to add to that. What is OCR? Because who is sitting here is like, what does that mean? That is, when I was teaching, that would actually be one of my first questions. And I'd have paralegal students or soon-to-be students sitting there going, I don't know.
Pick me, teacher.
What is it, Andy?
Optical character recognition.
Yes, it is. Which is different. Which is different than extracting text.
Do I get a gold star?
You get a strawberry margarita popsicle.
My whole day just turned around.
Which is obviously different than extracted text. Extracted text is what's coming out of a native document, like Brenda said, searchable text. But we call it extracted text because we're extracting it from the native source versus we need to take a static image and create the searchable text. We need to make it OCRable. That is what happens during the processing. Either the extracted text comes out or you kick off OCR to OCR things that don't have it. Just remember, garbage in, garbage out. You're going to get the quality of the document that you're putting into the system. If you have really poor quality document, your OCR is going to be as good as that document.
I feel like that saying really applies to pretty much every facet of my life. Some weekends I eat like trash and I drink too much and I wonder why I can't run very far. And it's like, oh yeah, garbage in, garbage out.
And I wonder why I can't run at all. Well, we've talked about what we're reviewing in the first place, and I think we've established what the content is, what the metadata is, what the fields are, and how they work in our review platform. Just a side note for OCR, it's very helpful when you are using a review tool that you are able to identify which documents do not have searchable text, so you can make very intelligent decisions about what you actually process and run OCR on to make them searchable. But now that we're actually looking at our data and we are beginning our review for whatever the reason is, I know that we need to communicate with one another documents that we find that are responsive or privileged or have some other type of relevance for our matter. So that's where we start talking about what the heck is the difference between coding documents, tagging documents, and labeling documents?
Well, for me, they are all the same, right? So coding, labeling, tagging, they're all a word that you could use for the same action that you're basically doing, in my opinion. Now, for example, a label or a code or a tag could be responsive or not responsive. And as the reviewers are going through, they're going to apply that description to a document so that it's easily identifiable one, but it's also easy for the review team or the legal team to say, I just want to see the relevant documents. I don't want to see the non-relevant, not responsive documents. So the concept of applying a descriptor or a label or a code or a tag means just that. I want to associate some piece of information or a label or code or tag to a document to help the review team find this and organize this later down the road.
And I'm holding up a sticky note. And those who have been in this a long time.
Oh God, I'm getting flashbacks.
This is the old coding, tagging, labeling.
Oh my God. I remember going to do doc review as like a little baby associate before we really had e-discovery software. And it was like, you would go through the boxes of paper documents, put your post-its on it, and then the photocopying vendor would come. Mm-hmm. And photocopy anything with a post-it on it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, in Missouri. Those days, so we're going to talk about horror stories up here in a moment. But in those days, a horror story was like if you bought the cheap sticky notes that the adhesive like wore off and fell off your documents. That's also a problem. All right. Well, I know that Christy is coding panel guru. Do you have any tips or tricks to share about coding pains and that type of workflow?
Yeah. And the clients that I work with, I show my kind of my standard template, right? And Angie has seen it.
I sure have. But we love it.
You have to have templates set up. That is going to create your consistency and not just a template that says, oh, this is for Angie, this is for Bree, this is for Brenda. No, one that's going to work across your litigation matter, no matter who's in it, no matter if outside counsel's in it, no matter if Angie or a paralegal are in it, that someone doesn't have to go start changing labels or adding new labels. You want to create consistency. That consistency allows you to do things like create coding rules. If this, then that. If you're tagging for privilege, you must tag a privilege reason. If you're tagging to redact, you must tag for a redaction reason because those are the basis for your privilege log.
I was going to ask, and Christy, why must we tag all of these things for privilege? Why must we say whether it's privileged and then tag a reason?
That is because you will create your privilege log automatically. So you don't have to go back and review a second time. Time is money. And
like
if your outside counsel is wasting time doing a second review, oh, why did I tag this privilege? Why did I redact this for privilege? You're now doing a secondary review of those documents where it could have been done the first time.
No one wants that. And listeners, if you're curious, want to know more, please listen to our Flock Talk episode of What the Flock is a Privilege Log.
You bring up some really great points, Christy. I love the rules, though it kind of keeps some of the mistakes from happening. I know something that we were actually just talking about before we hit the record button for this episode was how important it is to know who is in charge of making these coding panels and who we want to allow to create new labels, tags, or codes, or whatever you want to call them in your world, and why that even matters.
My take is that it's either going to be the litigation support, you know, whoever is running the project, whether that's your PM, that is the only person that should be creating any labels ever. You should not be giving access to teams of people to freely create labels. You are going to have a big mess because everybody wants something different. And that should flow through one person. And that one person makes those decisions.
But that one person should respond fairly quickly to requests to create new labels. Because sometimes issues pop up and then you're reviewing and you're in the middle of it. And you're like, where do I put this document? It needs a tag that doesn't exist.
Yeah. And what we had set up actually had a tag in there that basically said create new label group. And then basically just had a free flowing notes field. That way they can type it, they can check it, they can move to the next document. And that way that flow is not stopping and they're not waiting for someone to come back to them. And then at the end of the day, that person, instead of creating, you know, what if they just got 50 requests for 50 different tags? That person can go look at all of them at the same time and go, okay, I'm going to streamline this. And these are what we're going to create.
Very
right.
Smart.
I've got something similar from a lot of you. So we're going to create this one tag instead of three different ones.
Smart. Yep.
And that goes back to Christy's comment about the OCR, like garbage in, garbage out. Like if you don't have a clean and consistent, concise coding panel, it's just going to be garbage and everyone is going to be upset.
So yeah, it's definitely consistency and making sure that to me, it has to be one person, maybe two, right? Someone's on vacation, but there has to be people that are in charge of creating that workflow, right?
Also, Christy, you said my favorite word, which is workflow. I know we've talked about this in previous weeks, all of the various triggering events to a legal hold, review, etc. When you're creating a workflow for a review project, what are some universally applicable considerations for anyone who wants to build a defensible, consistent workflow when they're starting a review project, whatever that might look like for their team?
Clearly, it's going to be having your coding panel set up, right? Having your working with the team to basically create not just your template, right? Because you need the template that has kind of your standard fields on it, like groups and labels, but you also need what are the issues at hand? Who are my witnesses, right? Let's kind of get an understanding of what they're going to be tagging to, creating a review memorandum. We talked about that on the last one.
Mm-hmm.
That is critical to that review project. Nothing happens without that. You're not moving forward. You're not going to second base. It stops there. You have to have a review memo. what are these people doing? What are they tagging to? Why are they tagging it to that tag? What does that mean to them? What it means to one reviewer is not what it means to the second reviewer. So having a very clear, defined, this is, if you're tagging to this, this is why. Having that prepared, again, having usually, it's usually the one of the attorneys, either the closest associate to the case, preferably the partner, but right, you definitely need someone that understands the case. And ESI protocol, to me, this is important because you're making decisions on things like if the parent is responsive, the attachment is not, are they going together in a production, or are they going to get slip sheeted? Those are things that are very important when you're setting up a review of how are we going to set up the rules to kind of create these stages, right? Workflow stages, which is, you know, it flows from stage one to stage two to stage three to stage four. And that's going to depend on, is the family coming with it or is it not? How am I going to create my workflow is going to be based on that protocol.
I mean, you've mentioned a couple of really key things, but in terms of creating an efficient, defensible, strategic review, talk to me about some communication that's really critical to have between the different team members to make that happen.
Well, it's going to be who is going to be running the review, right? Who is, let's start with who's running the review. The project manager is usually the one that's going to be, you know, going through doing their QC. They're going to be talking to the review team and saying, these are the inconsistencies that I'm finding, either sending them back for a secondary QC, fixing them. But it's always going to be the project manager, in my opinion, that is going to be the one driving that communication, whether it's with the client, whether it's with the attorneys in-house, the paralegals. It's that project manager that you got to have one source of communication. It is super critical that that person has good communication skills. They've got good database skills. Being able to really step in, run a review project under a, you know, project plan, that might be another one that this person's going to have. You're setting deadlines all the time, right? They're court mandated deadlines. Where does that information go? We've got depositions coming up. I need a review team to review these, get them ready. And it's not, right, it's not just internally. I've got to get them out to get depo binders done. It's all sorts of pieces. It's calendaring. It's making sure that that PM is very much aware of litigation deadlines.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've seen worked really well is to have somebody at the end of the week going through, sending an email saying, you know, here are the common issues, here are upcoming deadlines, here are the things we should be looking for. It really helped everyone row in the same direction throughout the project. Mm-hmm. And having that like one person who was really plugged in, like had their fingers in all the pots, was so critical.
And this is where we used to have a Teams channel, where each review project had a Teams channel, right? Mm-hmm. So all the reviewers felt that they could drop their information in there and that PM would basically go in there and be able to respond. You don't want that going to an email because now nobody has visibility because they may have picked up on a key issue that now this PM is going to go, oh, now I've got to go maybe create another tag or maybe we need to address this with the team.
We've kind of hit all the high points of review. Should we, let's move on to some horror stories. So I think Bree and I are both dying to know some of your stories of reviews gone wrong. And of course, we will change all names to protect the innocent, but can you just share some things that have gone terribly wrong, some obstacles you've had to overcome?
Nothing went wrong other than the fact that where the review was taking place was a big problem. So many, many, many years ago, I worked for a company that staffed review projects. We had this major project going on, and it was at a location here in the Pittsburgh area. I had to line up like 30, 40 reviewers, finally got them all staffed and told them where to be. And we get out to the location. And as we're walking in, we're assembling in like the lobby. Someone comes out and hands us all these hazmat suits and expected our reviewers to wear these hazmat suits because the documents could not leave the building. So they had to be reviewed there on site. And needless to say, the next morning, guess how many reviewers showed up to review documents?
Ooh.
Not a single one.
I had a professor in college. I took one of those like classic undergrad classes called The Planets, and said this thing on day one where he was like, if I told you today, if all of you showed up, like I'm going to shoot one of you and you will die, how many of you would come to class tomorrow? And this is a class of like maybe 200 people. And everyone was like, no. Not going.
Yeah. Wow. It was crazy.
That's like one of those, I did not sign up for this shit moments.
Yeah, right. Good's not as advertised.
That was definitely the attitude. But, you know, I don't even know if we made it through the day, right? I think most of them, by the time we broke for lunch, everyone had already hightailed it out of there. Yeah.
Why were the hazmat suits necessary? Are these like radioactive?
Yeah, there was areas within the building that had radioactive content. So you had to be protected. Like they actually had lines on the floors where you couldn't, you literally could not walk past that line unless you had your suit on.
Wow.
Oh, my shit. Okay. Yeah, I'd probably pass on that too.
Yeah. Yep.
Good. I like my organs where they are. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
What about you, Christy? I know you've got a few horror stories under your belt.
I do. I've got a couple. Well, kind of a lot. But it was my first time ever being an expert witness in a case. And I had spent years on this case. And it was a case that we initially, the client was like, oh, we collected, you know, we just got PDFs, but we need to know who authored this document, right? Totally key to what we're talking about right now. And I'm like, well, where's the natives? Like, let's get the natives. Let's evaluate when the document was created, because you can't tell. A lot of fighting. Eventually, we got all the native documents. It totally proved what we wanted was the document was created way before the PDF. So I was able to go in, testify to the metadata. What does it mean? What does that date mean? We ended up winning. We won the case. And I was super excited. I came home and we had a big review project starting the next day. And it was a Friday night. I remember this pretty clearly. It was Friday night.
No.
And a client was like, we had a million document review projects starting the next day. A bunch of reviewers lined up. And we had an old database. We had two databases for this client. And one of them was just their test database that we were like making sure the labels had been brought over, right? It was just kind of like just the holding place. And I'm like, let me get this out of the system so they're not seeing it. And instead of clicking on that database, I clicked on the original database that the million documents were in that was ready to go, by the way, ready to get reviewers in and start the next morning. And I deleted it.
I'm sweating. This is like face level spiders.
I'm actually doing it right now. I'm actually like, that moment is coming back right now.
Oh my God.
And I sat there and it asked you, are you sure? I'm like, yes, I'm sure I want to delete it. And then I hit yes. And then it took like 5 minutes. I'm like, that's weird. It's like, right? Because it only had like 100 documents in it. And then I'm like, whoa.
Oh,
it's like
man.
The moment of like realization when the case I needed was gone. And I sat there and you laughed, Angie, but I actually did go get a drink. And I came back. I'm like, that just ruined my weekend. That's exactly what I thought. I'm like, well, my weekend's over. So let me cancel all my plans.
Yeah.
I know what I'm going to be doing this weekend.
It's one of those things where something like really terrible happens and you just kind of sit there for a second and freeze and then go, well, right. Like, the milk is spilled.
I need to start calling. So,
right.
That just hurts my stomach.
I think I got an ulcer after that. That was the worst. But I have another one of a client that decided to self-collect.
No.
Yeah. And I will always tell clients, and I have for so long, the pitfalls of self-collection are real, right? Because and some are intentional and some are not, but even the unintentional ones have very significant consequences where it's like, I thought I gave you everything, but I didn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a client was like, oh, I'm just going to update these meeting minutes because I never did it at the time.
No, sir.
So the first one where it's like the client didn't give us everything, we get into arbitration and basically the other side has it and they were just sitting there. They knew it. They knew we hadn't turned everything over. They were just sitting there waiting to say, you failed to disclose all these documents. Why didn't you turn them over? And you're just sitting there just like, what the F? Right. It's like, I hate the element of surprise.
Yes.
Right. It makes me want to vomit. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the client. Where do you go now? Like, what do you even say? And of course, he's like, oh, I didn't do it on purpose, but it had real consequences.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting sanctioned.
Well, I was going to say, it's like, well, yeah, your intent doesn't necessarily matter. It's right. Did you do a reasonable job of collecting? And right. then as the lawyer, you're kind of freaking out because you've right. got you have a responsibility to ensure that you have right. done your due diligence to produce that stuff. And you can right. get in trouble if you haven't dotted your I's and crossed your T's.
Thank God this was before the rules of conduct have changed.
Things were a lot slipperier back then. Right. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm not at a firm anymore, but I can't imagine certifying discovery responses. And right. without having verified that my client had actually done a reasonable job of looking for all the information that was responsive. Mm-hmm. Right. I can't imagine that.
You can only do so much, though, right?
Yeah.
It's like even with a questionnaire, you know, things slip through the cracks. And clients are like, oh, I forgot about that old cell phone that still has a lot of data on it.
No,
right? Whoopsie. I forgot to give you that, which I've had that as well. Oh, you've got like 5 old phones sitting in a drawer? Oh,
wicked.
Nice to know. Those are the things that bite you in the ass. Last quick story, and then I'll be done. And this is kind of goes to document retention. This actually favored the client because we had a client that it was a very well-established company, and their document retention policy was every 4 months.
Like, that's aggressive, folks.
But guess what? It was followed. You know, nothing on hold was, you know, gone, but right, anything else? Gone. And they followed it. They followed it for years. Guess what happened? So in comes criminal investigation. Government wants documents. And they're like, we don't have any. What do you mean you don't have any? We don't have any. Here's our document retention policy. And of course, by the time event takes place, government gets involved. It's now past your 4 months, right, window. And now the documents are gone. If you have reasonable, if you believe you have to put everything on hold, but they didn't think this incident was worth a criminal investigation, guess what? They didn't get indicted.
Wow.
The government had no documents to indict them. But that just goes to show any company that's holding 20 years of documents, not a good idea.
Yeah, No. Well, but I have heard like of companies getting in trouble too for having retention periods that are unreasonably short and just purging data like that and then getting into this situation and courts being like, you can't just do that.
But who sets that reasonableness standard, right? The government doesn't send it.
No. So, I mean, it would be like whatever the courts in your jurisdiction say, right?
Right. Does a court rule say that's too short? No. There's no sort of like what is reasonableness to
there's
delete
only,
data.
I mean, there's only regulated. Like if you've got something that's a health record or, right. you know, yeah. for regulatory purposes that you've got to keep it.
Right.
Otherwise, it is kind of a gray area.
It's gray and it's up to the company to say, well, this is our business record. Mm-hmm. Right. These are business records and they aren't on hold and we're going to purge them.
Right.
That was a really cool outcome because the client's like, that was awesome. Right. It's like it worked to their favor. They didn't do anything wrong either. The data wasn't there. So those are my kind of cool stories.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest horror stories, I mean, I think it's happened to so many people, is the inadvertent disclosure of, you know, information that should have been redacted or was redacted, but unfortunately during the production, they weren't burned in properly. That's a horror story, but I think it's also one of my biggest fears, right? And it should be everyone's biggest fear, honestly.
Absolutely. Well, folks, I think that brings us to the end of our show for today. Thank you so much, Brenda and Christy, for your time and for sharing your horror stories. And listeners, thank you so much for being with us today. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star review and tell all your friends, family, and coworkers about us, but only the cool ones. And of course, please hit us up on LinkedIn or at admin@ediscoverychicks.com with your thoughts, questions, episode requests, and drink recommendations. Until next time.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, everyone.
See you guys.